So now I want to welcome to the Wild Side News Jeff DeBelko with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He is the director of the Environmental Change and Security Program. Jeff, welcome to our show.
Thanks so much, Sidney.
You've been following the debate, is environmentalism dead? You've been involved in environmental work for a very long time. First of all, why don't you tell us about the nature of your work, and then let's get your thoughts on this issue.
Sure. We here at the Wilson Center are actually the official memorial to Woodrow Wilson, and we try to get together the worlds of research and scholarship with the worlds of policy, and particularly try to do that with some communities that don't often talk. Environmentalists, people working on health issues and demography issues, and we try to get them together with folks with broader portfolios in foreign policy and even security policy. And we find that although these groups don't often talk with one another, there are some areas of common interest and cooperation, and so we try to get them in the room together so that we might find some more effective ways to deal with some of these really pressing global challenges that we're facing.
Well, certainly this issue is plopped right into the middle of your efforts to bring about increasing dialogue amongst people who typically don't in framing these issues. Give me your thoughts on this debate.
Mm-hmm. One reaction I had to the discussion, which is really focused in many ways on positioning the role of the environment in the politics of the United States, would be that I'd take a step back and try to ask the question as whether environmentalism is dead in the larger stage of the world and public opinion there, and would say that actually it's a much more encouraging sign if we take that larger view and broaden out the scope of the discussion. I think in Europe we see in many ways the expression of the support for climate change in the Kyoto Protocol being something that really is quite encouraging in Europe, in perhaps in contrast to the United States, at least politically from the perspective of the United States. But I think it also, would see evidence in a number of developing countries when particularly it is framed as a sustainable development agenda, that there's quite a lot of interest and support for taking these issues seriously and implementing them in day-to-day. I think part of what we've learned at the Wilson Center is that it is critical to try to engage audiences that one doesn't always work with and to think outside our common areas of our common comfort areas in that respect. And so as much as that one message of the Death of Environmentalism report gives is to that the environmental movement needs to talk to people that we don't always talk to. And I think that does include certainly the private sector, and it does perhaps include faith-based communities. It does include talking to people at multiple levels of politics, so from the local to the state to the national, but also I would maintain more conversations internationally and understanding how people outside the United States can take these issues seriously and in some ways might help us frame the issues back here at home in more effective ways.
Why do you think that, in particular, the European environmental organizations and groups and movement are having a greater success than we are here in America, in the United States?
Well, I think part of what has happened is that environmental issues, in some sense, have not been as segmented as a specific interest or a specific set of arguments. And, in fact, you see a widespread acceptance across political parties for some of these environmental assumptions. And so there's a greater integration of environmental considerations across the board politically. That has then led to a kind of a more uniform and widely accepted sense of importance for these issues. One fundamental difference, it seems to me, would be the fact that in the United States, a lot of these disputes are settled through the courts. And with a fairly litigious society that we have here in the United States, and that is just not the case to the same degree in Europe. And so there are more opportunities for cooperation between government, between the private sector, and between civil society. And so the courts, it seems to me, tend to push sides out to their extremes. Now, obviously, using the courts has been a very valuable tool of the domestic environmental movement to push government and push private sector to take aggressive actions and provide very valuable protections. But nevertheless, these may be, in some respects, part of the cost.
I think it is that litigious nature that forces what Schellenberger and Nordhaus brought up, and that is the fact that this becomes a debate of very scientific and incremental, as opposed to a larger context. It almost forces that as the means through which environmental change is manifest.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I mean, one can make the argument that the environmental movement, it's its own success that in part has led to some of the difficulties. So we have seen great success in dealing with many of the end-of-tailpipe point source pollution problems, and they've been dealt with in many respects. Now obviously, we could debate about how there are attempts to roll back those protections. But in many respects, those were some of the easy battles, if we can say that. The harder questions of fundamental questions about consumption and lifestyle in terms of the transportation systems that we have, the dependence on the fossil fuel economy, these are the tougher nuts to crack that also have very set and powerful interests behind them that we've seen less progress in dealing with.
Where do you see examples of good progress in terms of creating this more sustainable society and therefore addressing the larger issue, which is global warming and climate change?
Mm-hmm. I would say that there are certainly advantages that places like the Nordic countries in Europe have. They have relatively small, affluent, and homogeneous societies that have some sense of societal consensus on being sustainable. But I do think that you are seeing a willingness to engage and take seriously renewable energy in lightening footprints in their transportation sectors, in trying to be cognizant of their larger climate impacts. Now, again, nobody's perfect. The Norwegians have the luxury of North Sea oil, which allows them to do, in many ways, be very environmentally conscious. So it's not that they're perfect and everybody else isn't. But I do think there are some places where we can see some of these technologies actually tried and to some degree subsidized by government so they can be given a chance, and that they should be signs of hope for approaches that we could take.
You've written a book called Environmental Peacemaking. That, to me, seems to be a universal that has terrific appeal, that concept. To which degree can the environment and the effort to preserve our environment really be broadened out into the concept that this will lead to peace?
The arguments that we grappled with in environmental peacemaking were premised on the notion that we have spent an awful lot of time looking at where tensions over natural resources have exacerbated conflict, whether that's actually violent conflict or more often contestation between parties. And we said we haven't spent enough time trying to understand how environment and the shared dependencies that we have by the very nature of the resources, how they can be pathways to confidence building, trust building, and hopefully peacemaking across these lines of tension. And in the book, we're actually looking at a number of different regional settings where countries do share environmental interdependencies and various ways that both governments but also civil society actors have used that interdependence and played on those environmental issues to find ways to talk and engage in dialogue that can hopefully bolster better relations in the area of the environment but also larger political relations. So in that sense, do see some kind of hopeful signs in some of these dynamics.
Do you address the issue as tensions decrease, this may free up greater funding for progressive sustainability projects and economies and things of that nature?
Well, I think that would be the hope. And in some ways, part of our argument is that governments and civil society groups haven't tried these approaches enough. So we're in some sense, not enough evidence to pass a lot of judgments. But if we look, for example, at the Nile Basin, where we have so commonly heard that the next war is not going to be over oil, it's going to be over water, and kind of the saber rattling that goes on in that region. But in fact, we've seen for, say, the past 6 or 7 years, very serious, high-level, ministerial-level negotiations where all the countries in the basin, all 10 of them, have said, let's try together to move together from arguing over our rights to water to talk about what we need the water for, and hopefully end up, and in some cases with their shared vision statement, ending up with how do we share benefits? How do we take off the political boundaries as a kind of exercise in understanding how we can cooperatively use water to meet our development needs, to keep them in a sustainable development fashion, and lessen the causes of tension among the different countries, and in that way bring some of the much-needed development in this poor part of the world, and not have to maintain the kind of heightened security perspective that that the water wars rhetoric, in fact, encourages.
In that sense, environmental issues are going to become, again, very mainstreamed in just in terms of survival and security.
That's right.
By the way, if people wanted to find out more about your book, Environmental Peacemaking, how might they do that?
Probably best would be to go to our Environmental Change and Security Project website, which they can find at www.woodrowwilsoncenter.org/ECSP.
Is environmentalism dead in your eyes?
No. No.
Has this been a useful debate?
Sure. When we challenge our basic assumptions, even if we don't agree with those challenges, forcing us to look at how we're doing business and our success and our failures is always useful. Some lessons we can take, whether we agree with the specific arguments of the authors or not, are that we need to constantly reevaluate what we're doing. We constantly need to look for new partners. We need to look for models of success outside our immediate context, and try to always be looking for new opportunities and doing better.
Jeff DeBelko, I want to thank you for sharing your thoughts on the Wild Side News. Jeff DeBelko is with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a great organization that is bringing voice, as I try as well to do, to some great minds and great new ideas that will help this planet in the future. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thanks so much.